I'd like to begin by pointing out that, as she says in the article, she is not a halachist. She's a philosopher. And a lot of the discussions I've had about this article with people, you're going to hear some of my very strong criticism of the article. People have said, well, what do you expect? She's only a philosopher. And I think that that's not really a defense. Because if you're a philosopher, and that's your strong suit, then stay in philosophy. Don't make statements which have very serious, not only serious philosophical, but theological and halachic outcomes, which are very, very problematic. And we'll see them as we go along. I should also point out that Dr. Tamar Ross, has republished this article in a slightly different format in Hebrew. Recently in several different formats. One was in Meimad puts out a magazine and it was republished there. And Nemaneh Tovah Avodah also published. There was a discussion of the article and there was a discussion back and forth. She was also very severely attacked for some of the reasons I'll talk about tonight, and she is backpedaling substantially because perhaps she did not completely realize she was attacked by Hannah Kahat, who was I think this article, the magazine, when she showed it, was this the one that right? But she was attacked by Hannah Kahat also, and as a result, she backpedaled. But I think what's nice about her article is that it shows you how feminism in its extreme can be extremely dangerous to halacha, to halacha position. So let's begin. And I know this is going to sound like a lecture, but if you really please jump in whenever you like. I mean, if you disagree or you want to take issue. And I know there are people here who do disagree with me, and we'll discuss. I know because I've had previous discussions with them, mostly over email. In any case, let's begin with a definition of feminism. What is feminism? Suggestions? How would you define feminism?
Well, a woman has the right to do whatever
she wants. Exactly. Something. They'll just give you the dictionary definition. Essentially, what it says: a doctrine advocating the same social, economic and political rights for women as that those granted for men. Okay, and it's absurd talking about feminism in a slave society, of course, but because, I mean, women can be slaves, like men can be slaves. But essentially, feminism says whatever freedoms you grant to men, they should be granted to women as well. It's, again, it's equality of opportunity. One of the major themes of feminism is personal autonomy. It is, I decide what direction I want to take. Now, there may be all sorts of factors. I may not have the intellectual gifts. I may not have the physical gifts. I may not, that would allow me to carry out what I want to do. But at least, as far as society around me is concerned, I have that opportunity. Feminism in its extreme attempts to totally destroy any gender definitions. But that is not what normative feminism is about. Yeah.
Let's agree. Shai is always a very healthy thing. And silent to a certain extent sometimes. And like part of different ending. You said women are not as strong as men.
Okay. They don't deny physical differences, but different but equal. Hold on, different but equal is not feminism. Viva la difference refers to certain sexual characteristics.
But not all men are equal either. Some are weaker than
correct. It's equality of opportunity. Different but equal is not equal opportunity. That's not what feminism is all about. It may be your shava, it may be your compromise because there's a clash, and we'll come to talk about that. But that's not feminism. Okay, now what is halacha? halacha, and I'm going to be using halacha, mesorah, meaning tradition, halacha is the Jewish law. Halacha is made up, what we call the halachic way of life is made up of three basic elements that I like to focus on, many elements, but three basic elements that for this argument I like to discuss. What has to do with revelation? That is essentially Judaism is based on the fact, as Rabbi Yehuda Levy said, the absurd claim that 2.5 million people were Mamad Har Sinai, 600,000 men, so around 600,000 women, and at least 600,000 children, if not several million more, approximately 2 million people were at Mamad Har Sinai, having this prophetic experience, in which they received, according to tradition, Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebichtav is the written law, and Torah Shebal Peh, which is also divine. And this is a very fundamental point, because this is one of the points in which we differ with conservative movement. That is, that Torah Shebal Peh is also divine, and the Torah Shebal Peh includes interpretations, definitions, expansions, rules for expansion, all that is divine. And that came down from Sinai. The second element is the element of Mesorah, transmission. That if I'm a halachic Jew, not only do I believe that there was a prophetic experience, but I have a certain commitment to the authentic, that the tradition that was passed down orally from father to son, from mother to daughter, from generation to generation, was authentic, was accurate. And the Mesorah plus the applications plus the principle transmitted by the scholars of the generation through the experiences of the generation, arbitrated to some extent by the Sanhedrin, is accurate and authentic. The third, I should also point out that in the second element, we're talking about the role of the Mesorah, the scholars, and transmission. There's also an element of interpretation. And we maintain that when Chazal come along and interpret, according to the rules, what the Torah means and says, that's also divine. That's an explication of Torah. That is, Chazal say, when the Torah says pre-Etz Hadar, it means Etrog. Etrog is now biblical. It's not rabbinic. It's biblical. And then Chazal were given the power in the Torah. Chol Asher Yaruchah. Lo Tasurim Min Smol Mikol Asher Yaruchah. There's a third element, which is crucial, okay, to this today's discussion, and it has to do with role play. In Torah, there are roles. You can't get away from it. There's Kohen, there's Levi, there's Yisrael, there's a Kohen Gadol who's different than the Kohen, and there's also men and women. And men and women have different roles. And these roles are defined by different mitzvot. Yeah.
I think back to Sarah for a second. I think for the sake of discussion, also to be with it, Mesorah doesn't mean that things were unchanging. I mean, isn't it a mitzvah about Moshe Rabbeinu coming to visit Rabbi Akiva? And he had like 95 years idea what was going on.
Yeah, nothing like 5 years idea what's going on. How does it develop itself? So the Gemara to God says, so he turns to God and says, why are you giving the Torah to me? Give it to Rabbi Akiva. So God says, shut up and keep listening. Essentially, it says the next one. But blatantly it says, keep quiet and listen, and this is my wish. And he listens and he hears when the students ask, what's the source? They say, halacha l'moshe mitzvah. That, all that means, and that's a separate lecture, what the students means is a part of the whole question of how much Moshe Rabbeinu know and how emotional about the facts issue. Okay? So the question is, the question fundamentally is that the simplest way of understanding it is that Moshe Rabbeinu got all the principles, right? He didn't get all the details, or even if he knew all the details, he didn't transmit all the details. Rashi says this was before he got the Torah. So there's all ways of understanding the Medrash. Fundamentally, I said Moshe Rabbeinu. I think the easiest way to understand Moshe Rabbeinu got the principles, and therefore Rabbi Kiva could go along and say a particular point. But when he was asked what the sources, this goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, because essentially that these are the development of the fun. Yes, Torah changes in its applications, and certainly development and application of problems it changes. The principles remain associated with that. Yes.
How do you define within the parameters of feminism?
I'm not talking about feminism. I just talk about feminism. I talked about halacha.
No, okay. How do you define? But I have
yeah,
to ask this question.
Please.
Okay, within the roles, within the framework of feminism, the difference between biblical and halakhic mean, you talked about the...
I know feminism, but let's, can we, can we go on?
You understand where I'm, what I'm asking you?
No.
No, I don't think so.
Got it.
No, but you're talking, there's a difference between biblical and okay, and rabbinic halacha.
From, is it feministized?
Yes.
Let me continue.
And I want to know where you draw the line.
Okay, where do you draw the line?
Yeah. I mean, where...
Essentially, once Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, we start with rabbinic.
Oh.
Unless it's, that's even the Torah. I mean, unless it's interpreted.
But is biblical...
Let me make a presentation, you'll get your answer.
Right.
I understand what you want, let me just...
All right.
Okay. Now, in the halakhic framework, now, there are different obligations. Sometimes these obligations are exclusive. For instance, a Yisrael can't be a Kohen, and a Kohen is not always allowed to do what Yisrael can. They are limited in the function, you're limited in the roles. You can't say, but I want to. And the same thing would be true very often in the man and the woman's role. There are certain things that women can do that men can't do. It has to do with tumah by a Kohen. There's a difference in the roles. Although a woman's role tends to be less specific, even what she has to do, I mean, her role is less defined. Her role is much more fluid. And we talked about that, talking about Saul Berman's suggestion that the man's role is very specific. A man's got to do this, A, B, C, they've got to have a father, he's got to get married. A woman doesn't have to get married, a woman doesn't have to have children. We protect her voluntary choice to that role. But there are no mitzvot that obligate her, and she has a much more flexibility in whatever role that she wants to have. But in any case, clearly the different roles of women are free from mitzvot asei shezman grama, and that defines what type of role she has. Now, in the halakhic framework, as a result of these three things, my personal autonomy is seriously limited, right? And Pesach, I was giving the Shabbat, I made the point several times that Moshe Rabbeinu comes to God and says, Shalach et ami, the avduni. Freedom, personal and communal freedom, is not an end of itself. It's a means. We view freedom as a means which allows me to do mitzvot. I have freedom to do what God wants me to do. And it's from a halakhic perspective, my personal autonomy is limited. I don't go, I want to have freedom in order to do what Hashem wants of me. And this comes from the very nature concept of there's a mitzvah and a mitzvah. Personal autonomy means I'm essentially, is a secular approach to life. It means man is, it's that the man or woman, okay, makes decisions in the value system, what he wants to do. Halacha is God-centered. God makes the decisions, and I have to fit into God's plan. So I have limited my personal autonomy. Second of all, in the halachic framework, Mesorah is central, and as I pointed out, it often makes the division between Orthodox and conservative reform. Conservative Jewry has more flexibility because it's only guided by halacha. Halacha may be divinely inspired, but it's not binding. For an Orthodox Jew, what the Masorah tells me has been transmitted for millennia. An Orthodox Jew is bound by halacha. A conservative Jew is guided by halacha. An Orthodox Jew is bound by halacha. We also have Emunat Chachamim, namely that Chazal accurately transmitted to us the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral translation of the written law from generation to generation, be it in the drashot, or the implications, or the definitions. That the ultimate goal of Chazal when they struggled with the text was not personal, was not for any personal gain or any for personal interest. It was merely to discover the Ratzon Hashem. Whatever God said, whatever how they understood God's will, that's how they would proceed. And they didn't like it. As we used to say in Brooklyn, tough movies. Love it. I mean, they were not out. They didn't have any axe to grind. They didn't have any agenda. Their item was not to win or lose. Right? It was to discover whether it's on the way. There's a very beautiful Gemara. There's one of the two major protagonists in the Gemara. Anybody who learns a lot of Gemara knows the two major, Abayim. Fire up, oh, it's the Gemara, fire back, And one of the classic Gemaras is where Abaye says, Rabbi, I give up. Rabbi says, why do you give up? You could have said this, and then you go on for that couple pages. Well, they switch roles, and each trying to say why he gave up, and the other trying to explain why you shouldn't have given up. And they keep going on, and they keep asking it out. Because again, it's not a question of I win or lose. It's a question of understand God's will. It's through the dialectic that we understand God's will. So we'll keep the battle until we come to an ultimate conclusion. There's also belief that through the millennia of analysis, we reveal the divine will honestly, objectively, and as rigorously as possible. So when I talk about feminism and halacha, there's a fundamental problem. The problem centers around the clash between personal autonomy versus guided or limited autonomy. Not that you don't have any autonomy. Of course you have autonomy. And from a halakhic perspective, there are things that we expect you to do. And if you're a halakhic Jew, the type of things that you can do or ought to do or should do is clearly guided and limited. Now, part of the problem is that all of us sitting in this room were essentially raised in 20th century values. We were raised essentially in a society that believed in humanism, in societies that viewed democracy not just as a means of government, right? It's not just a means, but as democracy, as my brother, if you hear my brother Dobie's lecture, he pointed out that democracy for 20th century man had become essentially an ideal. Democratic values is a distillation of Western humanistic values. Now that's how we were raised our whole lives. Now we believe that we could spend, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, that's what we want. That's what we were taught. And that means equality of opportunity. It means personal autonomy. And halacha doesn't necessarily say that. So clearly, halacha values many of the same things that 20th century values, but sometimes the priorities are different. Sometimes the Torah has a different ordering of things. And they may well not be the same. And it may turn out that 20th century values and halakhic values don't always mesh. That's the problem. It's part of the problem. Now, but there are creatures on this world, and I consider myself one of them, who view themselves as halachic feminists. So something's got to give. There is a certain amount of contradiction in terms of it. Now, the conference is called the Feminism and Halacha Conference. Right? There's been a lot of lumbus, a lot of teaching. Why does the feminism, why should the feminism and halacha conference? It should have been the halacha and feminism conference. I mean, which do you put first? It's, in this particular case, it was absurd, okay? But the question that's being asked is not so trivial, because there is fundamentally a clash between them. Halakhic feminists essentially want to say that if women feel that spiritually they are getting a rough deal, right? We have to try to, as much as possible, expand a woman's role as much as possible so she feels spiritually fulfilled within the bounds of halacha. Okay? One of the major problems is an attempt to define what is the problem and what is the halachic priority. Because one of the fundamental points I'd like to make tonight that as a halakhic feminist, you have to be willing to say, maybe the answer is no. And as you go through a lot of the feminist literature, they're not willing to accept that. That maybe the answer is no doesn't occur. You gotta push, you gotta shove, you gotta expand, you gotta do this, till you get what you want. Is that being honest to halakha?
You're just obliquely asking the question, Belvin, but no.
What?
If the feminists are just going to meekly ask a question, they'll be
put down. They see themselves as push-push, and the perimeters of halacha will be there, and we'll push our way and meet those perimeters to the degree possible. And it's not a question that we want to pass the perimeters, but we know as long as we keep
testing is keep the question on
us.
I was going to get to this point later, but let me ask the fundamental question. What is your goal? To have the halakha say what you want it to say, or to have the halakha reflect the divine will? And that's essentially what Rabbi Feldman asks, and in his, when the question comes up about women pushing and shoving, you know, let me just read you what Rabbi Feldman says. The real issue, however, is not the nature of minhag, but the nature of halakha. If the halakha is a tool with which to implement our own will, then taking the initiative is appropriate. And then taking the initiative means pushing, raising, hollering. But if halakha is a God-centered system designed to implement God's will and bring us closer to His ways, then it is obvious that calls for initiatives and pressure are incongruous. Because I think to some extent the point he's making is very important. Question is, when you demand that an issue be addressed, you want the best minds to deal with the problem and come and say to me, we've struggled with this problem, we honestly believe there's no way to change it. At that point, what are the feminists supposed to say?
I have nothing left there, right?
What?
On the part of the halachists, there's no personal will whatsoever. They're completely objective. I mean, that's what you're premising yourself on. Because if we, the feminists, believe that they're, then we don't have to. They're going to find the MS anyway. But if we believe Echshu, and that is what they believe, that there's a personal bias on the part of the.
Then I would say, then just keep trying. Keep thinking. Don't stop now. Keep trying. But I would say, in the meantime, let me just go through. Did somebody else want to ask a question?
Yeah, I just want to say, I mean, there's a very well-known principle, it's less of Hashem, it goes to Torah, right? I mean, Sarah Schneer, she was a, revolutionary.
Sarah Schneer was not a revolutionary. And the article, I like to point out, Sarah Schneer was not a revolutionary, this is revisionist history. And several points, I mean, the article that written by, the two articles written by, Levi Reisman, Lawrence Reisman, who's a lawyer in New York, and he knows his feminism well. Levi Reisman makes the point that Sarah Schneer didn't budge without consulting five or six adult women.
But couldn't the answer have been not no, but not yet? Because had that question been asked 200 years before that, when literacy was not...
Oh, you're right, I was right.
So then the answer would have been absolutely no.
I don't deny that, because there was... Look, this question of women's learning Torah is a question of public policy. Chazal made it clear it was a question of public policy from their perspective. Said what did the Chafetz Chaim say? The Chafetz Chaim says society is different. Women are going to university. They're learning promiscuity, whatever it is, whatever tiflut means. I don't want to get well learned it. Says they're learning it anyway. So what would you prefer brother have? They learn this tiflut or that tiflut? What would your brother have? Women prepared for the world outside or women not prepared for the world outside? I mean, you send them out to the outside world anyway and be totally unprepared? Strengthen them, prepare them. I mean, it was a public policy question. It's very clear that this is a public policy question. We go through, when we eventually get to that subject and we'll discuss it, you'll see that's essentially was the motivation. Plus, that a reading of the sources, which they believed was honest. Okay, and which wasn't just, okay, the women want it, we'll give it to them. That's not how it works. It's a reanalysis of the source, seeing what all the factors are, seeing what the realities of lives are, the life is, and then making a halakhic decision. And if it's a public policy decision, you weigh what are you gaining, what's being lost, what, how has society changed, and the factors of change, and you make a decision. Yeah.
I'm
don't think it's a problem if you're saying, okay, I'll limit my personal autonomy in order to say fulfill the Torah, which is divine will. But there's a problem when you say I limit my personal authority in order to their rabbinic establishment, where maybe their decision practices are influenced by
that. That's a very good question. It's a very good question. And the way to do it, the way to do it is you have to make a very strong distinction between what you call the rabbinic establishment, which are individual rabbis and communities, and people who are recognized as the gedolim of the generation. I don't think that anybody would argue that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein had an agenda. He was one of the biggest mekilim of the generation.
Right.
I don't feel it's fair of a man who's made life and death decisions for patients who's made that to charge him with that sort of situation. I don't deny that there are a variety of factors. It may also be that he represents Torah values and you, the ones asking the question, represent 20th century values and they don't know as much. I think that's an option that you have to consider, all right? But the fact of the matter is, the way halacha works, we don't have a Sanhedrin, okay? The Sanhedrin, the gedolim of the generation would sit, they would thrash it out together, the 70 scholars, and they would thrash it out together, and then we would have it, what is what considered the halachic view. We don't have it. So what happens is, there's a consensus built. The question is asked the leadership of the generation, and a consensus builds. And a consensus finally crystallizes, and many, it takes much longer time. That's how the process works. And even to assume that one individual, and this is part of the position of faith that we have, even if one individual may be slightly affected by his hashkafa, when you get a consensus of the gedolim coming together, you tend to get a position which is presumably more balanced.
But for example, the gedolim are for men, there's no women's perspective.
Now that is a fundamental premise that I want to get to. That is a fundamental feminist premise. The Torah is given by, transmitted by men, and the Torah is transmitted by women would necessarily be different. Okay, let me talk about that. That's one of the basic points that Tamar Ross makes when she discusses pushing with feminism in its more extreme forms. Okay. Now, I should point out, one of the things that bothers me more than anything else, and when Tamar Ross gives a list of problems that are in Judaism, I try to view myself as a halachist, okay? Not a feminist. And I want to prove that there's a point problem. I don't go ahead starting quoting literature from conservative sources, or from women who are extreme feminists. That doesn't prove the objectivity of the argument. For instance, she makes a starting statement that in early halacha, women were viewed as property. And who she goes ahead? She goes ahead and quotes Judith Hauptmann, who's a professor of Talmud at JTS. I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry, that's not a source for me. If you would come to me and you want to make a halachic statement, give me a halachic source for it. Okay? Because the statement is fallaciously false. Okay? Now, she says the role and value of women generally defined and limited by male interests and considerations. And then she lists sources. Every source is a feminist source. That's not objective. That's not scholarship. I'm sorry.
Okay,
now, just one second, but it's objectively not true. What about all the women, mitzvot that women have themselves, which have nothing to do with men? Chala, Nida, Nero, Tfilat Yachid, Milat HaSadim. What are all these mitzvot? They're all service to men? No. The point is that she makes the point that the primary role is limited by male interests and considerations. It's not true. That's what she says. Women don't have any identity other than with men. Okay? She says, men acquire women in marriage. And who's the source?
Why are they called Baal?
Why is it called Baal?
Well, I mean, I know that you said men acquire women married. I mean,
they don't acquire women. Are you a slave to your husband? Do your husband own any financial rights in you?
I think so.
Your husband owns. Your husband owns no financial rights in you. You come to your husband and say, I don't want you to support me. Whatever I earn is mine. It's your choice. It's a fundamental difference. A woman is a free agent in her marriage. Husband has acquired nothing but obligations. When you hear, I'm sorry. This is fallacious. It's not true. A woman, when a husband gives a wife the ring, okay, he's acquiring rights in his wife, to limit her, rights in his wife, to limit her to other men. He obligates himself to support her. He acquires maseya deha on the condition that she agrees to the agreement, which is she agrees to be supported by her husband, and in recompense, whatever she earns goes to the family property. But if she says, I'm sorry, I'm a high-class executive, I'm earning lots of money, I don't want to give you a penny. So you don't support me, and I don't give you any money. That's her decision. So the husband acquired her? Is there some physical property? How do you understand that? I mean, I can't believe that she doesn't realize that that's not true. The language nickname means to acquire obligations, or acquire relationships. It has nothing to acquire physically. She doesn't acquire the woman. There's no chattel. The woman's not the chattel of her husband. What?
But the woman was a chattel.
When?
Before.
When?
All of us were born. But it was a time.
Not in Jewish law.
Oh, yes.
I'd be happy if you give me a source. Okay.
The day-to-day life.
Excuse me. I'm responsible for halacha, not social values that are not ingrained in halacha.
One moment.
All of life was that.
There is a thing called shalom bayit, right?
Yeah. Okay. This is a joke. I can't resist it. But I was in Cleveland, right? So my husband, the guy's in the carpet, comes to me and says, what did you do today? He says, well, I gave my credit card to my wife. He says, that's what they call shalom bayit.
That a woman can have those words that you have just said to what you meant, I'm sorry.
What words?
I don't know your name, I'm sorry. That you said, when you spoke to her, you said that a woman will say, I am an executive, I make a lot of money, and I refuse to give it to you. And then you think that he will touch her on the head or on the face or head.
Well, look, all I can do, halakhically, I can't deal with what the social realities of that society are. I can tell you that if the husband would come to the rabbi, and the rabbi would say, she says, she doesn't want me to support her, she doesn't give me any money. The rabbi would say, it's her choice. It's in the Gemara, it's a Shulchan Aruch. It's her decision.
She can't dissolve the marriage.
We're assuming a normative relationship, you know. Excuse me, there are many, many second marriages in which there are laws of a premarital agreement in which just what I said to you occurs. Where the property does not transfer, where the husband's income does not go to them, and it's all just to be for the marriage. Now, I agree with you. I agree with you that in many societies, certainly before the 1900s, you could have nothing, something like this would never have been heard. Although the Gemara discusses it all the time. It's in the Gemara, 2000 years ago.
This didn't bring get home to their wives.
Exactly. How many women is it? Where should they get hanging in the new
information?
How many women are there until they got married? By the way, if you earn 10 times more than your husband, don't forget there's a clause for you there. No one does that. But what if the health halakha is on our side, but nobody's the, when the women...
I don't, it's on your side. I mean, I would hope that we have a relationship where no matter what my wife is, no matter what I don't share.
If we don't know our rights, what good are they?
So,
right.
So, but the men
didn't
know the rights either.
Yeah, there's another issue here also. When you just mentioned that a woman is theoretically not a man's chattel. How do you explain then within the Haredi community where women are arbitrarily told, this is going to be your husband?
She doesn't have to. She can refuse.
I
would agree with you that she chooses not to refuse. She wants to stay in the community, and there's certain rules by which
you can't stay. That's the whole point.
But you don't. Hanukahat, who's head of the Orthodox Forum here in Israel, is the daughter of one of the Dayanim of the Eid HaRedis. She chose not to be Haredit, and therefore she chose to marry a husband who's better than me. She chose to be a feminist, extremely knowledgeable. But
she couldn't have married a Haredi man.
No, she could not, of course.
But one moment, I would like to just point out one thing to what this beautiful lady said. I refuse to call her anything else because she calls me that. that a Haredi girl is told, this is the man you are going to marry. It was done many, many years in Europe. And they pushed the handkerchief into the girl's hand and said, no, you have the handkerchief. No, you are engaged. You can't break that. This kiyat kaf. No, you can't. You can marry him, and then you divorce. And when she married him, she was lost.
If she really wanted out, she could have gone to, you're right, there's a problem. I don't
decide. I am telling you that only these are details that I know of.
It's a beautiful
thing. And I just would like to have mentioned that for the reason that I may use the word, the girls were are probing into marrying that.
Agreed. Right? Halakha does not require it. There's tremendous social pressure.
But this is why I asked you what the difference is, where you draw the line between rabbinic and biblical law.
No, biblical law. This is social pressure. This is neither. And taking the handkerchief, making a contract, so she breaks the contract. But they said, worse to break a shidduch than to get divorced. I mean, it's absurd. Yeah. It's absurd. It's all absurd. Right? Okay, now the most problematic section of Tamar Ross's paper has to do with what she writes towards the end. And let me just read a couple selections and I'll tell you why the problem. I'm going to read some selections. Those that have it. I'm reading selections from starting from page 14, the second paragraph, page 14. Those who don't have it in front of you, just listen, because you'll see the point in front of me. Page 14. Though the feminist movement started as a movement for equal opportunities and rights for women, and the abolishment of discriminatory gender differences in the and the ideology it has generated this movement. This movement has become something broader, more profound. Ultimately, it purports to be a spiritual revolution which offers an alternative reading to world, God, and history. Skipping down, the feminist critique views the mainstream monotheistic religions as a powerful tool of patriarchy. Skip down to the last paragraph, in the middle. The feminist critique challenges the assumption that the Torah begins with a pure and uniquely Jewish view of women, which only requires occasional adjustment here and there in order to accommodate new societal concerns and realities. It suggests instead that the basic halakhic model of male-female relations is social-based and culture-bound and the reflection of a set of assumptions traceable to palpably ungodly forces which are not pure and distinct Jewish at all. On the next page, and then at the bottom of the second paragraph, that sometimes men and women may have different interests at stake which lead them to act and to interpret things differently, and that it was the male interpretation which by and large was incorporated as definitive in our foundational religious models and metaphor. Then two paragraphs later, feminist research gradually uncovers the extent to which a predominantly male perspective has been instrumental in shaping the development of halakha. Women are now gaining the courage to look at its meta-halakhic narrative more critically and voice aloud the skepticism they often felt regarding its claim to objectivity in its reading of reality. Now on page 16, the sixth line. Jewish feminists now begin to question whether the halakhic process has indeed always been merely a pristine playing out of the logic of its original sources and principles, utterly independent of formulations colored by male interests. The feminist critique makes the official explanation for many of the legalities that discriminate against women, that is, that these are a simple and technical working out of objective halakhic principles, appear unconvincing. Now, the bottom of that paragraph. As a result, women now sometimes read the current rabbinic intransigence regarding certain issues in the name of halakhic consistency or other public policy considerations as simply a defense of male empowerment, which can no longer be maintained because it has been shattered completely in outside society. Now, on page 20, in that third paragraph, and this is where the punchline comes, the feminist. Okay, in that paragraph that says the more radical towards the end. On page 20, the third, in that paragraph that begins the more radical conclusion. Skip down about seven lines at the end there. The feminist reading of Torah, which begins in suspicion of its male bias and continues in an attempt to replenish that one-sidedness with the addition of a female perspective, often ends up with a refusal to assign the status of divine revelation to a text that simply establishes and reinforces the injustices of patriarchy. The reasoning runs as follows. If Torah is from God, it should be above any human conditionality. It means it should make the difference whether you're male or female. The end of that paragraph, the last sentence there, the problem intensifies when we realize that all rabbinic commentary on halakhic legislation is based upon the legal and narrative sections of the Torah, which we always regarded by tradition as stemming directly from God and therefore immune to human condition. Okay. Now what she essentially has said there, Dr. Ross, okay, no, it's not in that article. It's in the Ross article, but it's all right.
I wrote it, do I have the other
one? I don't know. Let me just make the points, let me just summarize the points that you made. According to Dr. Ross, I should point out, is strongly influenced. Now, it's not very clear whether she really holds this. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the faulty argument, whether she really holds it, she's merely presenting. I read this article about three or four times, and I think that this is what she holds, or at least she gives it credence. But Dr. Ross is strongly influenced by what's called feminist relativism. What is that? Feminist relativism, this school maintains that since halakha was interpreted and transmitted by males, you can assume that therefore it reflects a male view. That if Torah had been transmitted by females, it would have been different. Now, yes?
She gives Mishnah as her problem. She doesn't just talk about the passage
of
halakha,
she talks about the actual text. Ah, right. She goes a little further. Why? Because once you've gotten that far, then Moshe Rabbeinu himself is suspect. Since Moshe Rabbeinu was male, then the Torah he got transmitted from, maybe the Torah that had been given to Miriam would have been different. And there's a lot of feminist literature. I have a library full of feminist literature, and if you read through it, this is one of the lines, that a Torah given by Miriam would have been different than a Torah given by Moshe.
She gives us the of the text as well, or anything that is inspiration, which basically...
That's no longer Orthodox. You can believe what you want to, but that's not Orthodox.
God gave the Torah to Moshe.
Okay, so that would be, okay, now what essentially, let me explain to you what she's saying. What she says, she's saying is, okay, we can solve Torah because Torah, that was given to Moshe, but you only solve the first four Sfarim. So we can solve Bereishis Shmot Vayikra Bamidbar and say Moshe was a conduit. And Moshe merely wrote down what Hashem told him. But Vorm was written by Moshe and edited by God. That's how most of you should understand. How to understand Vorm, which was written by Moshe, it's a little problematic, but I would say a very, very large percentage of the Rishonim learned that it was written by Moshe and then edited by God. So you can say, well, the editing God took out all the Shmuel Shovinist statements. I don't know, there's a lot left. Okay, let me just say.
I have a question. I don't understand your statement. The reasoning was as follows. The Torah is from God. It should be above any human conditionality.
God doesn't make distinctions between man and woman.
Wait, what does that mean?
God
said.
Who said?
Doesn't feel. God believes in personal autonomy.
Who said?
God. She said. Feminist said.
You're mixing two points. Somebody said that God may or may not think men and women are different.
Right.
That's one point. Then I think we should do show pass. So maybe a lot of people disagree. Totally different point is that. If at the time, since Moshe Rabbeinu, even since Rabbi Akiva, there were more women out there involved in
population learning, we had 20% of the population learning, the Torah would look different.
And the Torah?
I'm talking about Torah. Okay. If every person brings...
Okay?
What she is saying is, it's, you know why women are part of the mitzvah that says Shazman Grama? Because men gave the Torah. Men control Torah. If women were involved, the women would be higher than mitzvah that says Shazman Grama. You know why women are obligated to cover their hair? Because men gave the Torah. But if women gave the Torah, Sarah Aronoff said, the whole concept of Aguna and Gittin, and women were involved, the whole rules would have been totally different.
But that's true.
Why is that true?
There's a lot of logic to that.
I'm not arguing whether it's logical or not. I'm asking whether it's factual or not. The position of faith that we maintain is that the Masorah that we have is ultimately authentic and objective.
So who's authentic? Ask if that's a Hasidim.
Who's authentic?
We look at everything.
That's part of the dialectic.
But so you're saying there is room for wobble.
Look, had there been another Rabbi Akiva involved in the Torah would look different. I don't know. I would say that the Torah is constantly growing and there are new applications and new analysis. But I'm talking about the slant of Torah. You're telling me, essentially what she's saying is that all these rules that define women's roles differently than if women were involved, women and men would have the same roles. Excuse me, but that's what she's saying. I'm saying, you're telling me if there were another 10% of the population involved in the Torah, the Torah might be sharper, might more analysis, might more creativity, new pshatim, new... Yes! But you're telling me that if the women were involved, there'd be a totally different slant. That's the argument. The feminist argument is a totally different slant. That men are more involved in the details of halacha. Women are more involved in the philosophy of halacha. I don't deny there might have been more creativity in the Medrash. There might be more development in certain different directions. I don't deny that, that woman's mental power. I'm talking about the whole slant of Torah, whole application. The Torah would look different. That's their argument. And the reason the Torah looks the way it does is because men were in control.
You take
the
Chokmah, what woman had anything to say with that?
From a halakhic perspective, from a traditional perspective, the halakhot essentially came from the Torah. You know, chum wrote this way, chum wrote that way.
The women, not the women.
The women, Benot Yisrael. The major chumrah is Benot Yisrael. The major chumrah is the Benot Yisrael. And there are good reasons for it. There are good reasons because of the complication between... Excuse me, there are good reasons for it. The Benot Yisrael are very smart because it made their life much more easy. Much more, because I had to worry about Nida, and then I had to worry about Zaba, and then Zaba Gadol, and Zaba Ketana. This way, you just do it, and you don't have to worry about it. But it's... Tifa Dam Kekharda, that was all Benot Yisrael. Okay, sorry. Let me just, yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't understand that altogether. Why did you put out the covenant saying women can't be ATM or can't make decisions?
That comes, that's in the Gemara. The Gemara, based on the verse, Va'am Dushne Anoshim, right? The Gemara learns that it refers to males. The Gemara learns that they're psulim la'idut. And then as a result, because the quality of the Eidim and Dayanim, it's a machloket, so therefore the consensus of poskim hold that women can't be Dayanim as well, because if you can't be an Eid, you can't be a Dayan. But it doesn't, and that first different text,
right?
What?
From the Masorah, right?
But no, Dayanim is not from the Masorah. Eidim is from the Masorah. Dayanim has to do whether it's equated to Eidim or not. And there's a machloket, the midbachot of the poskim. The consensus of poskim is that you can't be an Eid, and you can't be a Dayan. If they go hand in hand.
I don't have much to say, but when it comes to, like, as we discussed in this class, a rub concerning whether a woman should say a kaddish with pasknish, you know, that's already...
So come back. Let me finish my presentation. We'll come back. No, but don't forget the question, because it's a very fundamental point. See, the claim is, you know why the rabbi didn't want women to be Eidim? The rabbi didn't want... Because they wanted male empowerment. They had an axe to grind. They wanted men in control. That's why they did it. That's the argument. Read her argument. She says it. There's no question about it.
I don't see a problem with that argument.
Because that Moshe Rabbeinu went ahead and said that we're going to destroy the seven Amamim because he didn't like the Sheva Amamim. Not because God told him. He told me to kill men, women, and children because Moshe Rabbeinu didn't like Sheva Amamim. He didn't like the way they looked. And I don't understand why our position is that as Orthodox Jews, it's part of our leap of faith. Not everybody has to make that leap of faith. But part of what being Orthodox Jew means, part of what that leap of faith is that we believe that the Masorah was authentically and objectively transmitted. And that these people were interested in discovering the divine will, not in empowerment, and not in being in control, and not that they had something against women, they were misogynists, and therefore they wouldn't let women be aided. But that they believed, honestly, that was the divine will.
Maybe it was silent time, women were without the mysteries.
But the Chazal, even feminists argue that the Torah and the Chazal were so millennia ahead of their time, breaking all the consensus of their time, so why are they not in that air? What? That's because Chazal weren't interested in role-playing. They didn't feel that women should have this role because it made them feel good. They did it because they thought that was the divine will. That's what Torah required. You look at the discussion about mitzvah d'aseh shas mayim, the women wear tefillin and don't wear tefillin. So, Rabbi Akiva held it. Women should wear tzitzis. Because they didn't hold it was a mitzvah d'aseh shas mayim. Didn't bother him that we're women wearing tits or not wearing tits.
No, you know, that's an exact example that people love people here saying. Because we went through all stuff that Mitzvah says she has money for math. And then we talked about, well, what if Mitzvah, and you know, any woman could volunteer to do any Mitzvah she wants. except for these couples.
But I didn't discuss this.
And then when someone raised their hand and said, why not? I'm not hand waving.
No, I won't hand wave. I didn't want to deal with it. And because if you want to, I'm going to stop and we'll talk about something.
It seems like after an entire halakhic development, then the punchline is kind of meta halakhic.
Well, you have to deal with the case. I mean, you have to think halakhically. I have to deal with what were the arguments and what it's based on. Tzitzis is not a problem. Moshe Feinstein begrudgingly also says a woman can wear tzitzit. If she wears a talit katan, nobody will they may not be happy with it, but because it's not normative, it's possible, but it's not no problem. Well, it was a much more serious problem having to do with it, even meddling. Okay. Now, you have to understand that a position that states that on feminist issues, the halakha can be relied on because it was transmitted by men, essentially says the halakha can be relied on for anything. Can't rely on anything. Everything's open for grabs. That's not an orthodox position. It's clearly not an orthodox position. Now, I should have to point out to you something very, very fundamental, that there are two types of transmissions, drashot. When we look, when we read the Gemara, and the Gemara says, the Gemara asks, what's the source? There are two ways of understanding these drashot, when Chazal say, we learn from this pasuk. There's what's called Midrash Mekayem and Midrash Yotzer. Midrash Mekayem means it sustains the previous Masorah. There are many cases where there are things that were transmitted from generation to generation that nobody questioned. Everybody knew they were true. And the question was to try to find the source. Okay? That's what's called Midrash Mekayem. There are other parts of the Masorah where the Chazal are looking at the text. They didn't have any statement, any ruling on this, and they're looking, trying to derive the source. Essentially, you have to be aware that not every time the Chazal give a source, they're sure that that's the source. Okay? That this is their searching for a source, but halakha was known. The halakha was clear for generations. Now, the first problem of the feminist position as presented by Tamar Ross is that it challenges the objectivity and authenticity of Torah and halakha. The second problem is that it overlooks the divided element of Hashkata Shechina, of what's called Elokim Yitzar Badat Kel. As Orthodox Jews, we believe that as the Torah is being transmitted, okay, Torah is not B'Shamayim. Torah was given to man to develop as the best as he can. But somehow, there is a Hashgacha to the position. That the Chachamim sitting in the Mishkat HaGazit, in the Sanhedrin, in the Beit HaMikdash, making their decisions, transmitting, which is the bulk of all Mishnaic literature, okay? And the distinction of Mitzvot Aseh Shazman Grama appears in the Mishnah, contrary to what Tamar Ross says, by mistake, she says, Amoraic. But it's Mishnaic, it appears in the Mishnah Kiddushin, appears in the Tosefta, right? And the discussion of that is divinely inspired. Others say that this divine Hashrat Shechina goes as long to the end of the Churban. Because they left the Sanhedrin left the Mishkan HaGazit before the Churban, years before the Churban. Some say down to the end of the Mishnah. Some say what they call Dat Torah. It goes down to the modern era, the divine guidance of everything that the Chazal, that Judaism, the consensus states. Essentially, what this feminist position maintains is that if it's man, male, given, transmitted, it's by definition suspect. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that there aren't social, economic factors in the Kabbalah. But there are. We'll talk about that in a second. There clearly are. But they're the exception, not the rule. The two main scholars of the generation who have dealt with this problem are Professor Jacob Yaakov Katz and Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, both Rabbanim, Rav Professor Katz. They both maintain that as a rule, position is that Torah is objective. There are not social factors. But there are times where there were major social upheavals and crises, and these created problems that were unprecedented, and they now needed to be able to continue functioning, creative solutions, different directions, different analysis. But that did not necessarily mean that the Gedolim of the generation solved the problem. If Soloveitchik says, for as many times as there is a solution, there's no solution. The answer we can't, there's nothing we can do. But no solution was found unless the postman believed that they were, quote, mechaven b'amita shel Torah. That they believed that the solution they were giving was emet, was true. It may have been a departure from the positions before, but they believed that that was the true pshat in the Gemara, that the previous generations had misunderstood the Gemara, and this now was the true definition of the Torah. Now, Soloveitchik says, he wrote several reviews in a journal called AJS, where he talks about these particular problems. He says, the furthest thing from the mind of a religious individual is to align the divine will with temporal need. You know what God wants? God wants whatever solves my problem. I got a problem, I got a temporal need, right? God wants me to solve my problem. You don't work that. First, I find out what God's need is. That need may be driving a new analysis. That may create this new problem, may create the motivation to re-understand the whole situation. But the answer for a posik must be kolei abu. Must be the posik believes that this is amita shel Torah. And at this point, this crucial point, the methodology differs from what many of the feminists are arguing, some of the arguments that you may have read in the Jerusalem Post article from Rivka Lubitsch and the like. If you read Rivka Lubitsch's article, first of all, it's a question of pushing and shoving halacha. How do you know which way to push? Do you know what the divine will is? Or is the divine will dafka what answers my need now? Right? Rivka Lubitsch talks about pushing the halacha, shoving the halacha, right? If women preserve the boundaries on every issue but this one and go a little bit beyond, we will remain in the Orthodox camp. What do you mean? This is not Beirut, the Shema. You can do, you have to keep Torah, you keep Torah, kashrus, cover your head from head to, cover your body from head to toe, but on this feminist issue, I can violate, and that's all right. The logic doesn't work. And she, there are several quotes. That was Rivka Lubitsch, but Rachel Levmore is a little more guarded. She said, the women want to be respected and have the opportunity to express themselves through a ritual in a way that they can find fulfillment within the guidelines of Allah. I mean, what bothers me very often, and much of what part of the article that Tamar Ross has written, talks about different ways of solving problems. Okay, the way the postkin try to deal with problems in creative fashions and analysis and the like. But the punchline that she wants to lead to is that if you have a particular problem, okay, you have to solve it. You do whatever you need to solve the problem. That no is not an option. And you pull out all stops to solve the problem. She's not concerned with Ennis. She's not concerned with the truth. What does God really want of me? It's simply we're doing what Soloveitchik says. I have a need, I want that need solved. Do whatever's necessary. Shoot the arrows and draw the bullseye around. I mean, that's not the way a posik works. A posik wants to know what the divine, will. Suppose I have a particular need. And there's a Mishnah that says, but fairish not that way. So one option, which is the feminist approach, is to say, that Mishnah was written by men, therefore we can throw that. That's their solution. Now, I should say that she gave this paper at what's called the Orthodox Forum. The Orthodox Forum is a discussion group in New York, essentially organized by Yeshiva University, and involves many, and also different topics. This one dealt with the different problems of modernity. And when she had made a statement, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was in the audience, Rosenzweig was in the audience, several people in the audience, and I should point out that when Rav Aaron arose in his very, you know, Rav Aaron is very, very polite, and he challenged some of her sources, and he claimed that her pshat couldn't be right based on the wholeness of Rishonim to the sugya. To which then Dr. Ross responded, well, you interpret it your way, and I'll interpret it my way. Now, you have to understand that brought the house down. Because you're not talking about, are you from it? You're talking a man who knows Shas and Post and Cold, right? And when he makes a particular statement, and you know if he made the statement, he's thought about it, he's chewed over 10,000 times, and he's bringing 2,000 years of tradition in his way. Okay? She's not only pitting herself against Rav Aaron, but against the whole line of tradition. And this really essentially, I'm not that she can't disagree, but I mean, it's as your opinion as my opinion. A little more humility. She's a philosopher. She admits she's not a halakhicist, and here is a halakhicist. Coming to point out that, but that's see, unfortunately, from my perspective, that more than anything else, to some extent reveals an attempt to solve a problem, not an attempt to really understand the divine will. Now, on the issue that Verlaine said, well, and Tamar Ross also brought it, we know how flexible Torah is. Right? After all, they had a problem. They had a problem with collecting debts during Shemitah. They set up Prozbul. They had a problem with selling the land during Shemitah. They had the Mechira. They had a problem with Chametz, big factor. Here's Chametz. Problem with carrying, Eruvin. The problem with interest, Sarah. Okay, these are the five cases always brought. Okay, there are no other cases. But even in these five cases, Eruvin is not a case because the same Isser, all these cases deal with Isserei Derabbanan. That's something that nobody points out. Isserei Derabbanan, not with Delaita, I'll give you an example. Prusbul. Shemitah in the time of Hillel when he set up was Derabbanan. Gemara says it's the Feirush because the majority of Bnei Israel did not return to Eretz Israel. The Gemara says it was Derabbanan. Het the Mechirin was in our generation, again, it's only Rabbanan. Mechirin comments, everybody does bitul, everybody nullifies it, so any comment you have around, the obligation to get rid of it is all Rabbanan. Erevin only works for Rabbanan, carrying in a Carmelite, it doesn't work. Heter Iska, which is Ribit, that has to do with a particular type of business transaction that's involved. In each of these cases, each of these heterim are based on bona fide halachot that were there all the time. The only thing that happened in each of these cases, what do you mean, a Jew couldn't go ahead and sell his chametz? Of course he did. So what was this heter mechira of the chametz? What happened to his chametz? He institutionalized it. That's the difference. Everybody does mechira. But a Jew could go ahead and sell his chametz? Of course he could. Before mechira his chametz. Prusbul, you put your shtarot in bedin if you didn't want to collect your debts after Shemitah. Right? And because Shemitah essentially nullifies the loans. So Prusbul, what did Prusbul do? Say, anybody has a loan, we put it, it's called bring your shtarot to bedin. So bedin collects, not the individual. It became institutionalized. So it's all rabbinic, no new law was on the books. It was merely institutionalization of laws that already existed. That was the difference.
As opposed to what?
As there was no creation of a new halacha.
But here the feminists want to negate.
They want to change halacha.
But rabbinic halacha or Torah
halacha? They want to change. They want to change. They want. It depends on how far the feminists want to go. Okay? So there is a fundamental problem with the extremeness of the position that was presented by Tamar Ross. It's a very, very problematic in its position. It presents some serious, while the position that she raises is a very problematic. I mean, some of the questions that you raise and the issues are in many cases troubling. The solution that she wants to present, at least the philosophy of, just raises serious problems with being a Halakhic Jew. And if you now read Lady Reisman's statements, you can see that some of his criticism is really quite valid because the priority is to solving the problem, not necessarily to understand, to commit into halacha. The Lady Reisman's problem with that is his presentation is not completely honest. But he talks about women learning Torah, so he cites only those poskim, right, that are against it. When he wasn't about women in leadership roles, he only cites the poskim that are against it. I mean, with women learning Gemara, for instance, he says, but the law on the book says that you shouldn't teach your daughter Torah Shabbat. He doesn't quote the fact that there's Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher Rebbe and many other lean poskim generations. They don't exist. I mean, he's having his truth as if it's, what?
He was not honest.
He was not completely honest in his presentation. Exactly right. So that's, you know, that there's the, anything that changed, that anything that is a change from what my grandmother did is problematic. By definition, problematic. That is a position I think is unfair to accept either, because we know fully well that particularly in things which are public policy decisions, and that was one example of Limud Torah, probably women saying Kaddish, women in community leadership roles, and the like. But that's not a problem. That's the analysis of democracy, which changes the rules, which we talked about. These things have changed. Society has changed. And with it, very often the analysis of halacha changes. Not the halacha changes, but the application, the movement into democracy. Democracy is different than other forms of government, which were before. And therefore, halacha changes, halacha does that. There is a dynamic. Halacha can answer needs, there can be creativity in halacha. Lady Weisman doesn't acknowledge that. He simply doesn't acknowledge it. What my grandmother did is what my mother has to do, what my daughter has to do, et cetera, et cetera. That's his position, and that's clearly a good position, although it's clearly obvious that women going out and being, you know, running businesses, multi-million-dollar businesses, it's not what my family did. And that, those societal changes are willing to accept. That there should be some growth in women's religious roles and the like.
I find that
in
Bechonda, a lot of issues in which women were more, had more to say, there were things that were different. I think particularly in the end of the divorce, where if a woman is more in divorce than her husband, there's a way around it. You get, I don't know all the rules, but you can get a way around forcing a woman to get a divorce, or not having a divorce and giving the man a heter to be married. While for a woman, I understand that the mechanisms are different, but they're not enforced. You put a cherem on somebody, men don't.
Is that the problem with the halacha?
Women can say, I don't like this halacha was written by men. I think men can say, this is about women, I don't have to follow it.
Your criticism of criticism with halacha, or is your criticism with the way that halacha is being implemented?
Well, people who have the power to make sure it's implemented don't bother implementing.
Then I suggest, then your criticism is valid. And I support you to now. And I agree that there are many, many organizations, Aguna being one of them, and the Jewish press runs it and is trying to create also. Yes, one of the major problems of the Aguna is that shuls, the recalcitrant husband gets a yod, and he's not ostracized, but that's a very major problem. Is that a problem? I don't mean, is that a problem with the halacha? Or is it a problem with society that when the betin says he's in cherem, nobody have anything to do with him, that the society doesn't respect the person?
Well, it's not just the society, it's also the Rabbanim. The Rabbanim could say do prenuptial agreements, but they don't, because they don't care enough.
But that's not halachic. Excuse me. That is not a halachic problem. That is a question with implementation of halacha. I'm not willing to go ahead and say we're going to throw out halacha because Rabbanim, in the Batei Din Rabbanim here in Israel, I don't have sensitivity from the theory.
So why don't Rabbanim of Shul have a guts to get up and say, you will get out of here?
I don't know why.
You don't know why.
I don't know what. Maybe because these guys pay their salaries. Maybe because he's got a lot of friends who are in the mafia. I don't know why. But it's not a halachic problem. It's not that the halach is at fault. It's people that are at fault. With people at fault is a problem. But the attack of the feminist school, okay, was that
the other way around, you would have found a way to enforce it. That is the feeling.
Excuse me, that is communal organization. That is, you need good community organizers.
And the
then I suggest that the women get involved. I don't look to, I'm not here to stand and say that I don't think the women should get, not be in leadership roles, or the women should get involved in the community. You got the wrong man. Right? I'm not that type of person. I think that you're 100% right. I think there's a tremendous room for, but I'm not going to go around saying that because there are certain problems, therefore halacha has to be changed to allow, make life easier. It doesn't always work that way. If the reason why aguna exists is because the halacha said that a man has to give a divorce to his wife, right? The man has to give a divorce to his wife. And we have to find social pressure mechanism to make sure that he gives the divorce to his wife, and that he can't go around living in society being a no good nick. The business that there is between men and women has to do with the fact that bet nikah hadin, originally men could be polygamous.
Not high on the male priority.
But does that mean, therefore, the distinction between men and women in halakha by giving it?
No, that's,
I didn't say that. That's what Tamar Roth said. Susan Aaron Roth said that if women were rabbis, the aguna problem would be solved. But, and she didn't. Excuse me, I ask you a question. All these rabbis, none of them had daughters and didn't get divorces.
When they do, they change.
Well, in Israel, they use the.
They didn't have sisters, they didn't have daughters who were in that situation.
Well, divorce is pretty recent. Come on, last divorce is pretty recent, so I don't go back to those 3 years on that.
Besides, I mean, if you really want to look at a man-oriented society, look at the Arabs. Do they care about their sisters or daughters? I mean, they'd assume murder them for shaming the family. I mean, you can't assume that just because they had some sort of close relationship with women that they were sensitive to their needs.
Okay, I told you, like, Jewish. I don't deny. We're moving into the 21st century, right? Highly educated women, lawyers, politicians, internships, the whole regard. So what are we doing? What's holding the system back is because they're not rabbis? That's what's doing it? Excuse me, if the women want to get together and wanted to enforce and wanted to make sure that these men were thrown out of shuls, there are case after case where women did just that. They stashed in the front of the home and they petitioned the day and night. And eventually they got together, they organized the community, they did these things.
Yes, but if the rabbi wanted to do it, the rabbi of the community wanted to do it, he could do it like that. It wouldn't take that.
No,
yes, because he's in a position to organize.
What position is he in? What can he do?
You don't have anyone, eventually anyone who will definitely serve the
chair. What?
Doesn't let anyone
observe the chair. But Arya, can't you argue that it isn't, or you're saying essentially that halakha is not at fault, that it's essentially man, okay, who is an earthly creature, who interprets halakha, okay?
No, who carries out halakha.
Yes, but it's also an interpretation of divine law.
No, the interpretation is clear. This man should give the divorce. The Bezalel says.
No, but I'm talking in general now, not just about divorce, but about all sorts of things.
I must say,
Rabbeim are earthly creatures. They're men. They bleed like everybody else.
Correct,
the point
but I don't
is, that if they're interpreting religious law, is it possible that their interpretation on some occasions can be less than pure, divine,
position,
or whatever you want to call it,
the
given bias?
Is that the consensus that the halacha, as it flows through history, represents the divine law. As it flows through history. Not talking about spot the decision, but even a Sanhedrin can make a mistake.
But man is the instruments of that divine decision, and man is not necessarily perfect.
Look, there was a divine will, there'd be a Holocaust too. Divine will. I mean, they said that in the days of Shammai, all of the halakha was according to Shammai, but in the end, everything will be according to Beis Hillel.
That's not a halakha source. By the way, that statement, find me the source for that statement you just made. But I don't. No, it's not brought anywhere in Shas. It's brought in some Zohar, some Kabbalistic statement. It doesn't appear anywhere.
Okay.
Listen, the hour's late. It's already getting 10 o'clock. Those who want to continue to stay, I'm willing to stay and discuss, but I don't want those who feel, that they have to go shoot the spiel.
I don't
want to
talk about that, so I want to go back to the question, well, when we talk about with women, it gets heated, but what about something like establishing the state of Israel? Isn't what you were describing in the way that halacha views something that's changing outside of religion? We're talking about social, but what about political? The religious Zionists come and say we need a state now, and the Haredim say no, it has to come from a divine.
Your question is an excellent one, because it turns out that if you look at the history, free state was like a 75-25 split as far as those the Haredim.
But isn't it the same?
Within 40 years, the history turned on itself. See, Tamar Ross even talks about it, there's a certain guiding hand in history that sort of, and she wants to use this to her benefit.
But when they say Shelo Yalu Kuma, aren't you essentially saying the same thing?
No, because there was 25.
Don't tell me what
there are 25%, including leaders of this generation, including many of the Soloveitchiks, including many of the leaders of religious Zionists, who were Gedolim, of Molliver. These were Gedolim of the generations, of that particular generation, who were in support, who believed, that honestly this was, there's no Sanhedrin that made a final decision, all right? Now, in that particular case, there was a strong battle, and the battle remains to this day
if you took a straight halakha, you'd say majority rules,
It doesn't always work that way. The three mechanisms, the scholar, the generation, there's a clear consensus that you have a case of artificial...
Ben Gurion making a declaration in the state is the same thing as Blue Greenberg saying, where there's a halachic will, there's a rabbinical way or whatever.
Yeah, so...
I say the same thing.
First of all, when Ben Gurion declared the state became into being because Blue Greenberg said that Allah
Shalom is the way to the state.
You're not forcing anybody. Listen, the hour's like, if you want to be in the discussion, listen, this discussion will not end. And I wanted you to... I know that the discussion tonight, I seem to have come down on Dr. Tamar Ross. The problems are not simple. The issues are really very delicate, and many of them involve a certain amunat chachamim that is part of what we believe. While there's Orthodox Jews, each of us as individuals have to make the decision about where we fall in this. In this position of faith.
Thank you.